Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Breaking the Silence, live from Houston, Texas. Just welcome to the program tonight. And as I'm looking out my window here, I'm looking at the beautiful Texas Medical Center at the Medical Center here in Houston, Texas. Right across the street, Texas Children's Hospital, MD Anderson. I'm looking at St. Luke's, and you can even see Harris Health, Bentall Hospital over there. Just wonderful as we're going into the winter season to be able to look out and but just welcome to the program this evening. I want to let you know that I am thrilled this evening. You will want to get on the phone right now or text some people and say, hey, wait, catch Breaking the Silence tonight, because we're going to have an exceptional program for you. And I am just thrilled with the guests. And I was just telling our guests right before we went on, we only had a minute or two to visit, but that this is probably the one guest, and I think he may remember, before my book even came out, I kicked him a copy of the cover and said, if you ever have a chance to read this, I would be honored. And he wrote back and he said, hey, we'll get with you sometime and maybe be on the program. And it took me over a year, but we finally got him. So we're going to be excited to have that tonight. Next week, we're going to have on the program Andy Anderson. And Andy is her and her husband, Ike. Run the Avaya University. And we just did a Wednesday morning around 6 o'clock, I did a workshop with them on loneliness and depression. And that's going to be running next week, the Monday following next Sunday's program with Andy Anderson. She'll be here. And in 2 weeks, we're going to have Vicki Jackson and Jen Thompson from the Lighthouse for Life, which is a program that deals with human trafficking. And we're going to really dive deep into that. And, of course, our guest tonight knows probably that Houston is one of the epicenters of human trafficking, and we're going to talk about that in 2 weeks. But Andy will be here next week, and then Vicki Jackson and Jen Thompson will be here the following week. So we have a great rest of November, and then December is jam-packed with some wonderful guests too. So I just want to welcome everybody tonight. We always like to have you call in if you want to, or you can get on the Facebook, Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page, and comment. We are live on several different platforms tonight. iHeartRadio is running this live right now. YouTube is running this live. We're just all around the world with so many different platforms. But if you get on the Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page, you can comment or ask a question. My son Curtis is watching that. He may jump in on the last segment of the program this evening if we have any questions. Or what we really prefer is you to call in live to 888-627-6008. And the wonderful producers there at BBS Radio in California will pick up and they will tap you right into the program live with us and our guest, 888-627-6008. I want to read, I wish I could, the entire bio on our guest this evening, but I want to let you know if I do, we would be out of time. It would take the full hour. But just to highlight a couple things so you know the impact and the wisdom of that our guest has this evening. Dr. Bruce Perry is the principal of the Neurosequential Model Network the senior fellow of the Child Trauma Academy. He is also a professor adjunct in departments of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University in Chicago and the School of Allied Health, College of Science, Health and Engineering at La Trobe University, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. He has authored probably one of the best-selling books that I have seen. I'm even honored that I'm on the same bookshelf at Barnes & Noble, but this book is a must-read for everybody listening tonight. You need to order it right now or go into Barnes & Noble and grab it. The Boy Who was Raised as a Dog, a best-selling book. And then one that I just finished reading this week, Born for Love. And both of those books are must-reads for anybody that's interested in this kind of childhood trauma, neuro and brain work and how all that is processing. And you would love these books. He is the author of over 500 journal articles, book chapters, scientific presentations, proceedings. And he also has presented around the world. I was presenting in the same conference with him, but let me tell you, I was in the closet down the hall when he was in the main auditorium and they were crammed and stood around the walls waiting to hear him speak. And he has presented at the White House Summit on Violence, the California Assembly, the U.S. House Committee on Education, and he's been featured. I can just keep going, but he's been featured on 60 Minutes, NPR, The Today Show, Good Morning America, Nightline, CNN, MSNBC, NBC, ABC, CBS, The Oprah Winfrey Show. He has been featured in documentaries by Dateline 2020, the BBC, Nightline, PBS, as well as dozens of other international documentaries. And he's also, print media has highlighted the clinical research of Dr. Perry, including a Pulitzer Prize-winning series in the Chicago Tribune, the Sun Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, Time, Newsweek, Forbes, Washington Post, the New York Times, and wouldn't you know it, the Rolling Stone. So it is an honor to have from Chattanooga, Tennessee, another great city in our wonderful country, Dr. Bruce Perry. Welcome to the program tonight, Doctor.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. It's my honor. I have to say,
your work.
Well, thank you. I'm really looking forward to having a conversation. I think, what you've been doing is really so important. You know, I think you probably can tell from reading The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. One of the things that I always struggle with is how do you communicate some of these issues in ways that people can, number one, tolerate. It's pretty emotionally intense stuff. And number two, understand in ways that they can connect to. And we're always struggling with that because, you know, a lot of our work is neuroscience work, or we do work that's kind of using the jargon of sociology or psychology. And, you know, if you're not trained the way we are, then you just, if people start talking in jargon, then people just glaze over. So that's why I think what you're doing is so important, talking about these issues all the time in ways that people can understand and connect to. So I'm honored to be on your show. Thank you.
Well, appreciate that. I tell you, I respect you because you take difficult topics and you present it in such a way that people from Southern Illinois, like me, can go, hey, I understand that. And I can read some of these books that are at the same conferences that we are at, Doctor, that's keynotes at these conferences. And in 10 minutes, they'll put them to sleep. You've never done that because you break it down to where it's, you put flesh on the medical jargon. And that's what I love about The Boy Raised as a Dog. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
And thank you. And just you know, lest people get the wrong idea, I've put many people to sleep.
me too. I already have this morning.
That I've learned over time. You know, when I first started teaching, I realized that it really doesn't matter what I know. What really matters is what I can communicate.
Yeah.
And so I've learned how to, and I'm still learning, but I've learned how to try to communicate and not overwhelm people with too much of the jargon, and because it's easy to do that, you know. And of course, because we'll get excited about our work and we'll start talking about things and, you know, use language that we've been using for 20 years. And then you look out in the crowd and you go, oh, that's right. You guys don't know what the locus coeruleus is. Yeah,
everybody knows that's a town right outside of Houston, right?
Exactly. Isn't that a suburb of Houston?
You know, doctor, you are probably the world's leading expert in childhood trauma. I don't think there's probably hands down around the world, not just in America, but I think around the world, most people that are on our show refer to you as a resource. And they always say, well, Dr. Bruce Perry says, and it's like, wow, okay. You know, and then now the other day when Jenna Quinn was on the program, she mentioned something about you. And I said, hey, wait, he's going to be on the program in a few weeks. So it's good to say that. Can you explain how, just to get a little bit of background on you, but, you know, we really want to get into some great topics, but now that that's not a good topic, but how did you get interested in this type of work? Because this is pretty deep and powerful stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because it really was sort of a serendipitous experience. I started out, I mean, it's actually kind of embarrassing, but in high school, I grew up in North Dakota, and I was a decent student, but I really was not a great student. I was a good athlete, and I wanted to go, you know, I had aspirations of, you know, doing college sports, and so I was recruited to go to college at Stanford to run track. And the Olympic coach in 1968 was the track coach at Stanford, and so I had seen the 68 Olympics, and I was like, oh, my gosh, he wants me to come run for Stanford. So I went to Stanford. I didn't really know that it was a good school. I mean, I knew it was a good sports school, but I didn't know it was, like, a good academic school. And I quickly found out that they cared more about, academics than sports. But what they do is they took all of the freshmen that would come in, and they would assign you to a senior faculty member, and they would lead you in a freshman seminar. You meet once a week. And just by luck, I was assigned to a guy named Seymour Levine. Now, Seymour Levine is a pioneer. He was maybe one inch away from getting the Nobel Prize, but he was a pioneer in studying the development of the stress response. And he's the guy who discovered that if you take a little rat right after it's born, a little rat pup, and you hold it in your hand, you immobilize it for 2 minutes, and you put it back in the cage and let it grow up and become a young adult rat, its brain is different than if it didn't have that 2-minute experience early in life. And when I heard that, I was like, what? That's really powerful, that a 2-minute experience at the right time in development can completely change the stress response systems of an animal. And so that's where I started studying, you know, the development of the stress response and how experience shapes the developing brain. And then as I went into clinical work, and I thought about being a neurologist, but I quickly found out that the neurologists, you know, they focused on strokes and headaches, and, you know, it wasn't as interesting as, for me, behavior. So I ended up going into psychiatry. And I had some really good basic neuroscientists who worked with psychiatrists who were my mentors. And so I've been very lucky all along to have really good, very generous mentors who were able to help me straddle these two different worlds, you know, the world of conventional clinical mental health and then the world of basic neuroscience. And so my work, when I sort of put those two together, that was pretty unique, you know, 25 years ago. So I was one of a handful of people that were really bringing the neurosciences into clinical practice. And now many, many more people are doing that now. And it's kind of, you know, there's been a lot of progress in it. But I think that in the beginning, we were just one of a handful of groups that were doing that.
Now, the impact, I think, of the story of the rat pup and being held for just a few minutes changed the entire way the brain functioned in that rat when it was a grown rat.
Exactly.
Made an impression on you. Definitely. That caused you, or did it not, just to go into and say, wait, could it possibly be that something that happens to me as a child of traumatic impact can affect me when I'm chubby and gray now?
Yeah. Those were the things that I was, you know, in my head, I was going, oh, this is amazing. Now, the thing that was interesting was I assumed, because this was such well-known neuroscience research, that other people had made that connection. So when I got into psychiatry, I was like surprised that nobody was talking about this. So I was like, wait a minute, like, aren't you guys talking about like the brain and stuff? And there were very few people that were doing it, because as you well know, and most people know, psychiatry emerged kind of out of analytic, you know, traditional analytic theory. And it's taken a while to sort of marry the neurosciences with the psychological sciences in a way that makes sense.
Can you do your explanation of the upside down triangle and the brain and how that all, because we have a lot of medical professionals, sure, social workers, nurses, doctors, clinicians, teachers, but then we have a lot of people that are just lay people that are looking for hope and wondering, okay, wait, how's this work with my brain? Can you kind of explain that upside down triangle? Because I love the way you do that.
Sure. So, you know, one of the challenges, of course, with the understanding the brain is that it's incredibly complex. And so we've tried to figure out heuristics or shortcuts, models, to capture some of the principles of the brain without overwhelming people. And one of the models that we use again and again and again is to just have people envision an upside down triangle, and that the top of the triangle is the cortex, which is the part of our brain that is most uniquely human genetically, and it mediates the most uniquely human functions like thinking, speech and language, future planning, the ability to tell time. And that's way up at the top of this upside down triangle. And then down at the base is your brainstem, the system that includes the systems that are regulatory. And these are the systems that basically are automatically monitoring your blood pressure and your body temperature and kind of, you know, the keeping you in balance, in equilibrium. And then there are systems that are between these lower regulatory things and then the top thinking part of the brain that are more focused on more complex regulation like sleep, and then you get into kind of emotional regulation and so forth. And so the brain develops from the bottom up. So the newborn baby, it doesn't need to tell time, you know, doesn't need to reflect on his past. It can't do speech and language. But the newborn baby has to be able to regulate body temperature and respiration and blood pressure. And so the brainstem develops in utero and should be pretty well organized by the time you're born. And if you're born prematurely, you need to be in an incubator to keep your body at the right temperature. And you need respiratory assistance because that hasn't developed properly. And so once that develops, then you can take the premature baby out of the incubator. You know, they can regulate the body temperature. Then they can do respirations. But as the brain develops, you start to acquire functions that are related to these organizing systems in the brain. And everybody, you know, everybody knows that babies, you know, they can't walk. And some of the milestones are they get to the point where they can hold their head up. And then they can roll over and then they can scoot a little bit and then they stand and then they're wobblers or they hold on to something. And there's this sequential acquisition of motor functioning, just like there's a sequential acquisition of social capabilities and cognitive capabilities. And all of this is reflective of the internal sequential development of the brain. Now, one of the things, and this is so important about this early life experience and the impact that that can have throughout your whole life, is that right down at the bottom part of your brain, we've got these systems, many systems and people have heard of these, the norepinephrine and dopamine and serotonin, these networks collectively, let's just call them our core regulatory networks. These originate in the lowest parts of our brain, but they send direct connections to every other part of the brain and through the autonomic nervous system and the neuroendocrine system, our hormones, to every other organ in our body. And so if something happens that causes them to be abnormally active, like a stressor or an intrauterine insult like alcohol, or, you know, and there are some other things, but those experiences will have a cascade of effects in all parts of the brain and body where these systems modulate and mediate function. And so you can have a couple of months where things are just terrible, terrible, terrible in your life. But if you're 18, the impact on your brain is going to be completely different if you have 2 months of terrible stuff happen when you're 3 months old. And so the younger you are, the more vulnerable you are to impacting these organizing regulatory networks, which will then have these powerful, important regulatory impacts on different parts of your brain. And that's kind of why the ACE studies that people have been talking about a lot, that's why when you look at the number of adversities that occur in childhood, you see a linear correlation with physical health, mental health, social health, just about anything you can think of. And the more bad things that happen early on, the more at risk you are for bad things as you get older. And some of the core mechanism has to do with how it influences these really important regulatory networks.
Tell you what, I'm going to process all that while we take our first commercial break, because we're on the other side of this. I want to find out more about digging about the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, and what happens if I don't even remember, doctor, on the other side of the commercial, a traumatic event that happened to me. If I can't even remember now, did it still affect the way my brain processes, and does it still impact me today, even if I don't remember it? And we're going to talk about that, even going deeper into this. This is awesome. Don't forget, if you want to get involved in the conversation, 888-627-6008, and we'll be right back after our first commercial break with Dr. Bruce Perry. We're right back.
This couldn't be coming at a better time. Have you ever felt like you were just trapped and couldn't find your way out of darkness? Have you ever felt like you were drowning and fighting to find your next breath? Well, coming in 2020 will be the second of a three-part trilogy, my new book, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. This new book will provide you a step-by-step approach of how to reach that destination, that important destination called hope. Now, two additional resources are going to be made available when this book is released. One, The Map to Hope. It'll be a handy guide that you can carry around with you, put in your briefcase or put in your purse. And this guide is going to help you find your way when you're stuck in life looking and searching for hope. And then the other resource, the Overcoming the Darkness Companion Journal. I have always believed that journaling is the first step to finding real healing and hope in your life. And this journal will guide you down that path. I'm excited about these resources and this new book that's going to be released in 2020, the Summer of Hope. Now back to the next segment of Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams right here on BBS Radio.
Welcome back. We were with Dr. Bruce Perry this evening, and he is in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it's just an honor to have him with us this evening. 888-627-6008. As we continue the conversation, Doctor, you was talking about the brain, and you just started mentioning ACEs and adverse childhood experiences. I believe majority of the people that listen to the program have heard that time and time, but we may have some new listeners tonight. The impact of an adverse childhood experience on a child has what kind of power if it's not buffered with an adult presence or therapy later on in life? And then the question that I left right before the commercial, if it's even a trauma that I don't remember, what kind of impact does that have on my brain and my functioning and the outcome of who I am later on in life?
Well, you actually brought up, I think, probably the most important part of the whole ACE story that frequently gets just kind of glossed over. And that is that we tend to over-focus on the adversity and under-focus on the presence of buffering relationships that can basically counterbalance the adversity. And so let me do a tiny little thing about the ACEs and then talk about why relationships and connection are so important. That what we know is that if you take a bunch of adults, and this is where the original ACE study sort of did what they did, they looked at 17,000 adults and they asked them simply, before age 18, did you have any of these bad things happen? And there were 10 bad things. Now, as you and I know, there's a lot more than 10 bad things that can happen to you when you're growing up. Yep. So they didn't have every different type of adversity that is possible. They also didn't ask, when did the adversity take place? And as we just have been talking about, it matters, right? So if you have something happen when you're very, very, very young, it will have a different impact on your developing brain than when you're older. And that's because the brain's at a different stage of development and these core regulatory networks are less vulnerable when you're older. And then the third thing they didn't really ask about is, were there healthy relational connections that were able to help you during the adversity? And so what we found and what other people found as well is that number one, the timing of adversity matters a tremendous amount. Number two, if that your history of connectedness is a better predictor of your current functioning than your history of adversity, and which is a very hopeful message. What that basically means is, even if there are all kinds of things that we can't control, natural disasters, you know, there'll be people that are impacted by war, poverty, exposure to community violence, domestic violence, all kinds of things can happen. But if in that person's life, there's a healthy school, if there is an after school program, if they're connected to their community of faith, if they've got an extended family with a few healthy people that would be present in the child's life, that child's going to be able to tolerate a lot of adversity and still end up pretty healthy. Now, back to the original question. The original question is, if left unbuffered, developmental adversity can have a lifelong impact on your physical health. You know, it'll influence your cardiovascular system. It'll influence your skin, your gut. It can influence the way you think, the way you feel. It influences your immune system. And so you will have increased risk for struggling with substances. You'll have increased risk for struggling in relationships, higher divorce rates. You'll have increased risk for struggling in school and school failure and having a hard time being employed. You'll have increased risk for a whole host of mental health problems, depression, anxiety. So adversity is a tremendously potentially toxic set of experiences. And one of the things we've become really interested in, and I wrote about it a lot in that Born for Love, is that, you know, human beings have always had adversity and will always have adversity. it just is, there's no way around it. But what we used to have better than we have now was connectedness. The modern world, the size of the household has collapsed from 8, 9, and 10 people in a multi-generational set of interconnected families in a community to 60% of some urban areas in the United States have one person living in the household. So, and when those people are in the household, they're watching television or they're on a screen 12 hours a day. And so the relational connectedness, the stuff that makes us physically healthy, is something that's just dissolving from the modern world.
So what kind of impact can connectiveness have on other people? You're saying tremendous.
Tremendous. I mean, pick any topic. If you want somebody who's struggling with drinking too much to get better, if you don't address, if you don't pull them in, make them feel connected, help them build healthy relationships, no evidence-based program is going to work. Same thing with the mental health problem. You know, there's all kinds of interesting studies about schizophrenia. The rates of schizophrenia, for example, that people that develop schizophrenia in multiple cultures is the same across the planet. But the morbidity, the number of return hospitalizations and bad outcomes is much worse in Western cultures because of the way we're fragmented and the way we, instead of pulling in people that are mentally ill and holding them closer, we push them out and exclude them. And it's heartbreaking.
Do you think with what's going on in the world right now, that on the other side of this, if there is another side of this, but there will be, I have hope that there will be, that mental health will be looked at through a completely different set of eyes because everybody's going to have a touch of issue that they need to deal with?
Yeah, you know, that's such an interesting point, Dr. Williams. We've already started to see that happen. That, you know, for people like you and I who've been trying to get our colleagues and our friends in the world to understand some of these issues around stress, trauma, mental health struggles, if they don't have a personal touch point, it's just an intellectual exercise. So they can intellectually say back to you what you've told them about, you know, mental health this, mental health that. But until, or stress this, stress that, or kids that grow up in a household where there's, you know, they're being abused, have a hard time concentrating in school. And they're like, yeah. But now that people know what it's like when there's all kinds of unpredictability and uncontrollability and you don't, and changes in your routine. So the way things have been happening, I think in many ways, give us an opportunity to help people who haven't been that sympathetic about these things to connect to what we're talking about in a real way. And I've actually had lots of people, I've gotten emails from people that I've been trying to communicate with in the policy world about the importance of mental health funding, who literally have sent me notes and said, now I get it. And as everybody has been seeing and reading, rates of anxiety, rates of depression, rates of suicidal ideation have all just been going up during the last 6 months.
Yeah. The environment that a child is raised in then, whether the trauma happens within the home, has a major impact on the way the brain's wired then, does it not? So the parenting obviously is a huge issue in our world today.
Huge.
How do you deal with this? How do you do the training? How do we do the education of what they need? Not just, hey, stop abusing your kids, but right, if they're not abusing their kids, but they're not providing them that safe environment to build them up for when something happens to them out there, what's the difference of that than doing this at home when their kid walks in, they're traumatized?
Well, you've hit really on a core issue in our culture. Is that it used to be when you were, you know, envision sort of a 1,000 years ago, and you're growing up in a hunter-gatherer clan or in some extended family agrarian setting, if you were a 4-7-year-old child, you saw babies, you held babies, you took care of the baby, you learned by the time you were old enough to be a parent, you'd had tons of hands-on experience with the prevailing child-rearing beliefs and practices of your community.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not they were good or not, that's a different issue. But the fact is there was a mechanism. You were around babies. You were around kids. You took care of them. It's there. You could not escape. You were part of the caregiving package. And so when you had your own baby, you know, you kind of knew what was considered good practice. Right now, because of the compartmentalization of our culture and many families having one child, and they're never in the way we have first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. You know, the fifth graders really don't spend much time with the kindergartners. You know, they don't really, they see them, but they don't interact with them. So by the time you can actually go to Princeton and graduate with a degree in child development and have no experience with raising a baby. And so you could be a crappy parent, even though you have an academic degree, and you won't know how to manage feeding them. You won't know how to help them with sleep. You won't know about how to have healthy discipline because we don't teach that.
Yeah. Wow. How about something that I'm experiencing and I've dealt with several people that have experienced recently? PTSD. And possibly, because we tend to focus that just on the military, and we know what that it does to them. But with what's going on in the world, with what's going on with trauma, with police officers, first responders, what's happening in our hospitals right across the street, not so much now, but our numbers are starting to peak again. But there for a while, it was not a war zone, but it had that feeling of, uh-oh, patients are lined all the way down the hallway. And the nurses were doing double shifts. And, you know, what kind of impact does PTSD have right now? And how do you help them overcome that?
Again, great question. You know, we've had several opportunities to talk with people in very high pressure medical settings. We have colleagues in New York and then colleagues in California that were really, really struggling. And a lot of them are developing post-traumatic stress disorder. They're getting sensitized to, you know, they hear another siren and they're like, oh my God. And they just are feeling overwhelmed. And they're exhausted. They're tired. There are people who were nurses that are just are wanting to quit. I think that we're going to have a lot of longer term problems. There's a tremendous amount of feeling of in the beginning, there's this, and again, you probably know this, but whenever there's a big community disaster, whether it's a big school shooting, a natural disaster, there's this initial mobilization of energy and effort. And people are, we can do this. And this is where you see these wonderful things about human beings. You know, they give their time, they give their effort, they give their energy, attention, they're supportive. And people, very often there's more volunteers than you even know what to do with. But that over time, that starts to fade away. And then if the crisis persists at about 5 to 6 months, you dip below your previous baseline and you get to the point where almost everybody has less energy, they're less functional, they're less capable of volunteering and giving. And this is kind of where we are now. We're afraid, you know, and I see this with teachers, parents in workplaces. And now what will happen is people start disengaging from anything that's taking up too much bandwidth. And so it's self-protective. And a lot of times that bandwidth is, you know, some people are having to quit their jobs. We've had a lot of women have left the workplace so that they can manage what's going on at home with their kids, with homeschooling. And there's a lot of other things that are like that. But what's happening is there's going to be a consolidation period, and then people will get back to their baseline at some point. But this is a very typical curve that we're seeing. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time just trying to help people understand what to anticipate and what to expect, because the unknown is what makes people even more anxious. So if you tell them, listen, we know what's going to happen. We've told many of these places to plan for this and to be prepared for this. We get asked to go into these big disasters all the time in the first weeks. And I always say, no. I say, listen, here's what's going to happen. You guys aren't even in a position to really think very clearly. In a couple of weeks, all the smoke's going to clear. And the real danger period for you and your community and all the people in the system is really at 6 months. And let's sit down and make a plan for that. And ends up being, for us, the most productive use of our time. But yeah, we're kind of all right now at this really challenging place. And I, you know, during the commercial, one of the things that you talked about was hope. And I think that's right now, people need more than anything a sense of hope. You can hang on if you know that it's going to get better. And it is going to get better. But people need to hear that from someone that they trust, someone who has a little bit of authority. And I think that's a big part of what we've been saying is, you know, we will teach people about, here are the predictable things that'll happen under duress. Here's some risk issues. Here's some challenges. But be hopeful. This is going to pass, and we know how to manage all of the things that are going to come out of it.
Wow.
But we're going to have to manage them. That's the thing. It's like it's going to be a burden, but we can solve this problem.
Yeah, I agree. 888-627-6008. We're going to take our final break. And then on the other side of this break, Doctor, I want to talk about how important is this new phraseology everybody's talking about, trauma-informed? Yeah. What? Trauma-informed communities, libraries, schools, health centers, cities. What does that mean? And we're going to talk about that on the other side to find out what the importance of that is to be able to provide the hope later on the other side of this last commercial break. We'll be right back with the last segment of Breaking the Silence.
HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers A Child Called It and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
I tell you what, this hour is just flying by, and I knew it would, but I appreciate you giving us this much time, because I don't even think Oprah got this much time with you. So
I should tell you that actually this week, I think we're probably going to announce it, but she and I just finished writing a book.
You and Oprah. Fantastic. You know, she mentioned, and I've been using this at conferences pre-COVID, that Oprah mentioned ACEs. And now everybody's going to, so what, you don't have to let the cat completely out of the bag, but poke its head out. What's the book about, Doctor?
It's about trauma, you know, and actually one of the things we talk about is, you know, what is this trauma-informed stuff? You know, what does that all, what does that mean?
That segues right in. And so, what did you and Oprah figure out?
Well, it's so interesting because I appreciate you kind of, the way you were talking about it, like trauma-informed this, trauma-informed cookbook, you know, trauma-informed, you know, Scotland declared itself a trauma-informed country. And I'm like, yes, really? Like, good for you. Tell me what that means.
Yes.
So I have to say, when I talk about our work, and people ask me about trauma-informed, I say, you know, honestly, there are lots of different definitions that have come up, that different organizations have come up with. And the field still struggles with it, because you'll have people, for example, the SAMHSA, which is a big federal agency focused on mental health, they've got a definition, but that's different than that National Council on Behavioral Health, which is different than one of the big ACE connection groups.
Right. And
so, you know, if you're out there and you're trying to get a clarity about what it is, you're not going to find it. But there's a couple things that all of these definitions do include. And that is an awareness that traumatic experiences, both in the present and in the past, are going to influence the way people think, feel, and behave.
Yeah.
And then if you don't take that into consideration, you're going to basically look at problems with the wrong lenses on. And so if you don't sort of have some appreciation of the power of trauma, you may, for example, see a child in a classroom misbehaving or not learning and label them with a learning problem or with ADHD. And of course, that's all well-intended, but you've got the wrong lenses on. If you put trauma lenses on and listen a little bit and watch a little bit, you'll recognize that maybe this is a child who's actually having a fear response. This isn't a traditional attentional issue. This is sort of a reaction to intimacy or some other issue. And so this is why it's important to teach educators about trauma so that they've got the right lenses to use when they're trying to interpret a behavior. Or if you're a physician, we do this all the time. A physician comes in, a kid comes in, or an adult comes in and they have headaches, chronic abdominal pain, and they'll do all kinds of stuff to work them up, but they want to ask about what's going on at home. And, you know, as soon as they ask and find out that, yeah, you know, I lost my job and my husband's also unemployed and he's been angry and at home and there's a lot of tension. And pretty soon you realize, oh, these are somatic symptoms that are very common under duress. And so the intervention is completely different than sending her off to a GI specialist. And so that's what trauma-informed means, is that teaching people across the board about, you know, how trauma can impact your physical health, your mental health, your behaviors, you know, and we actually teach these concepts to people in corporate settings because, you know, if you look at the pervasiveness of trauma, easily one third of the workforce has some form of history of trauma that impacts their ability to do their work in one way or another. Now, it may not be something that happens all the time, but it may be why they have these episodic periods where all of a sudden they're at sick for 3 days in a row and you don't really understand why.
Yeah.
And so.
So to me, I do a little session with the residents and the fellows at Baylor College of Medicine, where we talk about ACEs and then we talk about the trauma informed and kind of throwing that in now, that not only should you ask as an upcoming doctor, hey, what's wrong with you? But by the way, what's happened to you?
Yeah.
Because if not, we're going to just be giving drugs to deal with the symptom and not the problem, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's exactly what we're doing right now, unfortunately. You know,
so you look at people that have issues and then they're on medicine and they never got back to the root of the problem.
Exactly.
So how much do you buy into the neuroscience and the neural readings and the neural testings and the neural waves and, you know, calming all the brain waves down? And what kind of depth of that do you see in the future? I know there's a new wave of that coming.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. We know a lot of people that use neurofeedback very successfully with people who are dysregulated. And basically, if you're dysregulated, that means that these core regulatory networks are, they're either overactive or overly reactive. And you can change those. I mean, because of the plasticity of the brain, brain's changeable. And so there are a lot of approaches, but neurofeedback is one very positive way to provide lots of tiny little regulatory doses that over time can help those systems, or at least some of them, become less reactive. So we've seen it work very, very well with some people. Alternately, we see some people that just aren't able to use it very well, and it's not the technique for them. Part of what we've been trying to do, and you know, we're, even though we have 100,000 cases where we've got data, we're still trying to figure out ways to look at the way an individual's has been impacted by developmental trauma, and then use that to target appropriate treatment approaches and interventions. And the preliminary, you know, it's really not that preliminary. So we've been doing this for about 10 years. And the data that's emerging is very promising. Obviously, there's always ways to improve things, but we feel much more confident now than we did 15 years ago that when we get to know somebody and get to know what happened to them, and we look at the way they're currently organized, that we can put together a treatment approach that really does help them sequentially organize and reorganize systems in the central nervous system that have been impacted by trauma.
What's some of the, or maybe one of the things that's coming up on the horizon in research that really has got your blood pumping, like, hey, this is going to be a life changer? What would some of those be?
Well, there's two things that we're really focusing on a lot.
Yeah.
One is what I talked about earlier, is that just the power of connectedness. Relationships are multiple studies have shown this, and our work show that if you've got relational connection, if you feel like you belong to a group, if you are meaningfully connected in a reciprocal, respectful relationship with a certain dosing, it's not like it's once a year, but if you have this density, you're going to do pretty well. In contrast, if you don't have that, no matter what kind of evidence-based, enriched therapeutic stuff you get, you're just going to sort of tread water. You won't get worse, but you're just going to tread water. So that, for us, that's very exciting. The second thing is what we're learning, and I've always known this, but we're now beginning to see how to do this better, but that a dose of therapy, a therapeutic change can happen and does happen in very brief doses. So if you look at through the lens of conventional mental health, the dose of therapeutic change is 45 minutes once a week, right?
Right.
But that's, to the brain, that's a completely... that's not a very biologically sensible dose. The brain prefers to change with lots of brief doses all day long. So if you have relational density, the person who is struggling has lots of these dosing opportunities with people around them. And we've used the term therapeutic web to talk about the treatment model that allows individuals to kind of get their therapeutic experiences through people in their lives, not necessarily the therapist. And when you look at it, we really think that most therapeutic change takes place in context of an interaction with a youth minister, an extended family member, a parent, a coach, a teacher. And if you've got a lot of these people that kind of understand trauma and understand what happened to this child, they're going to provide all these wonderful opportunities for this child to basically be valued, to be regulated, to have an opportunity to learn and grow. And that's for me is exciting, because it's depathologizing the therapeutic process. You know,
that's fantastic. I tell you, doctor, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being here and the wisdom that you has given me and all of our listeners tonight is just unbelievable. When's the co-authoring book with you and Oprah is coming out? When's that?
It should be May, April or May.
Of next year.
2021, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Doctor, I appreciate you being here tonight. I can't thank you enough. If somebody wants to find out more about you, maybe read your complete bio and all of those things, and even watch interviews with you. I've watched them all on your website. What's the best way to get to that website if somebody wants to tap in?
Probably the best is the www.neurosequential.com.
Yeah.
That's the best place to start.
Okay. Fantastic.
And some of the best content is on, we have a COVID resource page where we did a lot of presentations and a lot of conversations about COVID related issues, but they're relevant for non-COVID situations as well.
Yeah. Great resources. Great for resources. Well, thank you for being and giving up an hour of your evening.
My pleasure.
Thank you for allowing you to lock yourself in the room and don't bug me for an hour with us tonight. And I really appreciate it. If you haven't got, folks, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog or Born to Love, get those tonight and start reading those, and they're going to bless you, I promise you, and just give you things that you can help other people with. And no matter what we're going through, just determine right now that we want to be one of those champions to be able to help somebody else out, because everybody needs somebody to bend down and look into a child's eyes and say, hey, are you okay? What can I do for you? Attaboy, keep doing the good work. You know, that kind of thing. Everybody needs that. Doctor, anything in the last, we got 1 minute left.
Well, I just wanted to say, I want to thank you for your work and for your life. And for you sharing the painful parts of your life with people, that makes a big difference. It's reaching people who would have otherwise never—they've never been reached out to. So, what you're doing is really important, and I'm grateful for your work and your life. Thank you.
I appreciate that, and kudos back to you, Doctor. And thank you for all the stuff you've done, and the impact we'll know one day, but it's been tremendous. So thank you. Thank you for being with us. As always, we always want to close the show out saying, no matter what you've been through, no matter what you're into, and no matter what you're going to go into, there's always, and lean in, there's always, always hope. And I promise you that. There's always hope. Never give up on that. Join us next week right here as we join with Andy Anderson with Avaya University for another edition live from Houston of Breaking the Silence. God bless you. Have an awesome week. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1 for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.